This is the Walking Home from the ICU podcast. I'm Kaylee Dayton, a nurse practitioner and ICU consultant. I help teams create awake and walking ICUs through evidence-based sedation and mobility practices. By hearing from survivors, clinicians, and researchers, we'll explore how to give ICU patients the best chance to walk out of the ICU and go home to survive and thrive. Welcome to the ICU Revolution. Awakening and breathing trials are not new. They were the very first elements of the ABCDF bundle that started in the 1990s and early 2000s. Go back to episode 150 to listen to Dr. Wes Ely talk about how this all started at least 28 years ago. In 1996, Dr. Ely did the first breathing trial study in which they did routine screening, then shut the vent off for 2 hours. They found a 1.5-day decrease in time on the ventilator. In 2000, Dr. J.P. Kress published an awakening and breathing trial study. He found a 2.4-day decrease in time in the ventilator and a 3.2-day decrease in time in the ICU. In 2008, Dr. Girard repeated this SAT-SPT study and found a 3-day decrease in time on the ventilator and time in the ICU. They found that patients that had daily SATs and SPTs were more likely to be alive 1 year after discharge. For every 7 patients that received daily SATs and SPTs, 1 life was saved. So in the beginning, it was SPTs. Then in the early 2000s, SATs and SPTs. Later, the ABC bundle. Then it became the ABCDEF bundle in 2014. Now, in 2024, true revolutionists will agree that SATs and SPTs should not be the focus of the ABCDF bundle for most patients. We should be evolved enough to be questioning whether or not to even start or continue sedation, as we know better than to treat the bundle as an on and off switch for sedation as a standard. We should be mobilizing all patients possible and truly minimizing or avoiding sedation. Nonetheless, we see that from these studies, daily SATs and SPTs absolutely save lives and improve outcomes compared to continually running sedation without a break. By this point, in 2024, every single patient that has sedation running and does not have a rare exclusion criteria such as elevated ICP, status epilepticus, or neuromuscular blockade agents should have their sedation shut off enough to be able to do a breathing trial every single day. If we are not at least doing daily SATs and SPTs, we are not providing standard of care, not giving patients the best chance to survive, and are even causing many patients to die. Now, as a nurse, admittedly, I hated SATs, doing them at 5 a.m. without a team that was ready to support me in keeping patients safe and working through the agitation. It was stressful and it didn't feel productive. Awakening trials should be done with the goal of mobilizing patients unless there is an actual physiological instability that necessitates the resumption of deep sedation. SATs and SPTs for all patients that are sedated should be standardized and integrated into routine cares, just as non-negotiable as daily bed baths and AM labs. But now in 2024, how are we doing? Where are we at with this? What is it like to try to roll out these programs and teams that still do not have standardized SATs and SPTs? I'm excited to have a new friend share her experience as a pharmacist. Her journey reaffirms the struggles of innumerable revolutionists that have reached out to me with the same frustrations and sorrows over the past few years. Her name and voice has been changed to protect her from retaliation. Kara, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Can you introduce yourself to us?
Yes. So I am a former critical care clinical specialist. I trained at 2 major academic medical centers after I finished my PharmD degree. I did 1 year of residency in a general pharmacy practice residency, and my second year was a specialty residency in critical care, at which point I started practicing in critical care at a smaller hospital, not a huge major academic medical center, but I was there for over 10 years.
Wow. So you were deeply ingrained in the critical care world. And the reason I bring you on is because you had mentioned to me that you had tried to launch an SAT protocol and it had a lot of really relevant experiences that I think a lot of people listening to the podcast will be able to relate to. But what inspired you? I mean, when did you launch this protocol and what led you to do that or to try to do it?
So our hospital had some unofficial versions floating around of you know, spontaneous awakening trial protocols that never really went through the right channels for approval. There was never a cohesive rollout. So I was in a multi-hospital health system as well. So that also factors into things. As anyone knows who works within a system, it's a little bit more difficult to get things done because you have to get agreement from all the sites that are involved. So, you know, we had various hospitals using various protocols, and that went on probably for the first 7-ish years. And it was actually during COVID, during the pandemic, we were a COVID unit, that I realized, you know, we need a official protocol for this. There also was, at the time, they were trying to do a trial. I'm not going to mention the specifics of it, but the trial was being run by respiratory therapy, and they needed to do an SBT as part of their research study. But we had no SAT, so you can't really do the SBT without people doing the SAT first. So I got involved. I you know, wrote up a protocol and decided I was going to take it through the official channels. This was like in the very end of 2020. And it went, you know, I had some obstacles getting that done. A lot of pushback came from nursing, really wanted to not turn off the sedation. They our pre-existing, you know, protocols that were unofficial, that were floating around, had really complicated titration recommendations, like turn it to 50%, then an hour later do this. Like, it was very hard to follow, I think, for nursing. And as far as I know, there's no data for what those protocols contained either. So I did eventually, you know, through citing studies and just being very kind of, you know, I harped on this, that I thought it was really important that we turn the sedation off as part of our SAT. That's very standard practice. And so I was
about those early SAT SBT studies that have been replicated.
Exactly, right. So, and then I was able to get it through, and it went live, I think, in January of 21, January or February.
And how did it go?
So, you know, there was a lot of barriers to implementation, I would say. There was an educational presentation that we made as a system about the ABCDE bundle, ABCDEF bundle. And it was, for whatever reason, that I'm sure there was reasoning behind this, but I still don't truly understand. They didn't make it mandatory for nursing to watch, which I think it eventually became mandatory perhaps the following year. But when it was launched, it wasn't made mandatory, which was very frustrating to me, because I think it was a great tool and it wasn't, you know, wasn't being utilized. So that was tough. I tried to do a lot of education myself at our hospital in small groups. And I know we have a nurse educator whose job it is just to do nursing education. So he, you know, he helped too with that. So education, I would say, was one issue. We also had to build all of our SAT exclusion criteria in our EMR. We had Epic. So, you know, that takes time to do as well. And we did eventually get all of that built in there. But then even so, people will still get the exclusion criteria wrong. So you constantly would hear, well, they're on a presser, so we can't do the SAT. And so I would say, you know, that actually, the SAT may actually get the patient off the presser, which it often did. Oftentimes, that is the outcome that we would
have. Especially during COVID, a lot of these patients were on pressers, but only because they were on sedation.
Yes.
I mean, right. I rarely saw COVID patients on pressers because they were rarely sedated.
Yes.
So absolutely. Yes. So, can't take sedation off because you have a presser, and can't take the presser off because you have sedation. You're just chasing your tail for how many days straight?
Exactly. And that was a huge thing I heard over and over again. So I think I got to the point after I had been able to dispel that as, you know, as a myth. Another issue that we faced was was the incorrect documentation of the RAS to begin with. So we would have people documenting the RAS as negative one, which, you know, is like negative one or negative two or zero, which is technically, you know, lightly sedated. And the patient was not, they were actually a RAS of negative three or negative four when I started digging in and asking the questions. That was another issue. So, you know, our protocol said if the patient's already awake, that you don't have to do the SAT because the patient's already awake. So if you know, you're documenting a RAS of negative two, then the SAT wouldn't be getting done because that was, you know, that was an indication that the patient was already awake. So that was another issue we faced. I was here a lot of times.
Episodes 134 and 156 support this. These are from nurses that have done audits or that have entered the ICU with a fresh perspective and are seeing the same phenomenon of this really inaccurate subjective interpretation of the RAS. And both face a lot of, I want to say persecution, a lot of pushback for raising these flags. So one of them was a nursing student that did an audit for her capstone, and she presented this information to the nurses, and a number of nurses stood up and walked out of the room. Mm-hmm. As they were so offended. And she was sharing objective data. She was comparing what was prescribed, what was charted, and what was objectively observed at the bedside, and found that 58% were inaccurate. And 68% of those, I think, were at least 2 points or more off of what was charted. So negative two would have been negative four, which doubles the risk of dying. So she shared that. Nurses got offended and left. Another one was... she's a very seasoned med-surg nurse. She really studied up on this stuff as she entered critical care. And her mentoring nurse was getting mad at her for charting a RAS negative four. And was like, no. Why did you chart that? Take that off. They're negative one. And she says, am I misunderstanding? I've watched YouTube videos. I'm looking at this chart. It is not a negative one. And it was just this constant thing where she was almost being pushed into this culture of lie about it. And I don't know if the mentoring nurse really saw it that way, but that's how she perceived it, of as don't follow the chart, don't go objectively, go with what was previously charted or what I'm telling you to chart. Mm-hmm. And so you're saying that was one of the big barriers, is that if they were within this range, there's no need for an SAT, but they weren't actually in that range. That was just what was being charted.
Absolutely.
Terrifying, considering that it is an independent predictor of death.
Absolutely. It is. And you know, seeing that over and over, it's so difficult to watch. We also would have a lot of people, you know, well, their PEEP is high, even though that was not one of our exclusion criteria. Our exclusion criteria was a PF ratio under 150, which is actually more conservative than other SAT protocols that use a cutoff of 100. So
the ironic thing about that is we have a Polly Bailey study in 2007 where it showed it was safe and feasible to mobilize and usually walk patients with a median PF ratio of 89. And yet here SAT criteria requiring a PF ratio. I mean, you don't sedate for ventilator settings. Mm-hmm.
So when I proposed the SAT originally, I had proposed a PF ratio of less than 100, and the pulmonologists they wanted me to increase it to 150. So we did that, but it didn't matter because we still would get pushback, and it wasn't just from nursing that, you know, they're in a high PEEP, they can't tolerate it. I had physicians saying, if I'm ever on a ventilator, don't wake me up, when I would bring it up on rounds. I had, you know, physicians, we're not championing this. So I would have, you know, them saying, well, they're going to be out for, they're going to be down for a few days anyway, so we don't need to wake them up. And I would say that is actually all the more reason to wake someone up if you anticipate a longer ventilator, you know, duration, because the longer they're on the ventilator, more deconditioned they're going to get, the more sedated they are. So that was another issue that we had. I had nurses just straight up refuse to turn sedation off. Just, I'm not doing it, even though the patient was an SAT candidate. So that was another barrier that I encountered.
And so there's variable, if not across the board, little physician support. As a pharmacist, nurses weren't necessarily responding to your either recommendations, invitations. Sounds like a lot of this is rooted in not understanding the risks of sedation, not a lot of the misinformation about sedation being sleep, humane, safer, necessary.
Yes.
It's going to improve acute respiratory failure, which is the exact opposite of reality, which I think a lot of people are can totally relate to. This is something that is a very common thread throughout every team that I've worked with, every team I've worked in, and everyone that I've talked to. You have an alias, we've changed your voice, and yet this could be anyone, any pharmacist sharing this. These are common practices, common myths that are in our ICU. I'm also astounded by the misunderstanding of the pharmacist's role. Did you feel like nurses were territorial of sedation and didn't want to hear it from a pharmacist?
Yeah, I have a pretty wild story about that. I was sitting in my office one day, and one of the directors of nursing for the hospital knocked on my door, and she came in and said, so the director of the ICU, the medical director, he came to my office today and said that you're talking about sedation too much on rounds, that, you know, it's got to stop. You're taking up too much time. And then she went and proceeded to give me every reason why they couldn't be, the nurses didn't want to turn sedation off because we're coming off of a pandemic wave, because nurses don't want to get injured, which I completely understand. I was friends with all the nurses. I did not want them to get injured either. And there's a safe way to do these things. She just was giving me reasons why. And I said, I pointed to Wes Ely's book on my shelf and I said, have you read this? Because I would highly recommend that you read this. And she, before she was a director of nursing, she was a critical care nurse, and then she was a critical care nurse manager, which was very, very upsetting to me. That was actually the day I started looking. I said, I can't do this anymore. If I don't have any support by leadership, I have to get out of this job. I cannot watch this anymore.
Yeah, that is heartbreaking.
It was awful.
But it still kind of makes sense to me. I don't think a nurse from any other discipline would have been as bold or felt as strongly as she did. She's coming from years of experience of treating delirious patients, sedating patients, following a lot of the same mentality, the same practices, and falling into the same gap in education. So yes. Now having this new authority without the right foundational knowledge, it makes sense to me why that she felt so threatened and defensive on behalf of the nurses. And yet, as alone, I say you're a revolutionist. You were very alone in being so concerned about delirium, increasing mortality from sedation, what would happen to these patients during and after the ICU from the sedation, being the only one to feel that way, not just feel that way. It's not just about feelings. It's about knowledge. You know what's happening. And it's hard once you know, you can't unknow it. You can't not.
Absolutely. And another issue was, once we had in our EMR, once we had these things built, we could look at data, right? So we could look and see what percent of the time are nurses completing the SAT screen. So I would sit in these meetings, and the percentages, I have to say that my hospital was the best out of all four because of me, because I would harp on it. So the percentages were not good, right? They're not good. So, and then when that came up, the reasoning was, they're doing it. They're just not documenting it. And I would have to speak up and say, actually, I can tell you that I'm on rounds every day asking about it, and it's not being done until I ask it to be done. And then even then, sometimes it's not getting done. So it was kind of trying to minimize the problem and almost turn a blind eye to not see what's really happening each day in the unit. And I said during that meeting, I said, we are harming people by over sedating them and not doing the SAT, the SBI, not doing the bundle. And people did not like that I said that. Let me tell you, people did not like that.
And I commend you for being so bold. If you've been listening to this podcast, you're likely convinced that sedation and mobility practices in the ICU need to change. The ICU community is facing incredible difficulty with the trauma from the pandemic, staffing crisis, and burnout. We cannot afford to continue practices that result in poor patient outcomes, more time in the ICU, higher healthcare costs, and greater workload for the ICU team. Yet the prospect of changing decades of beliefs, practices, and culture across all disciplines of the ICU is a daunting task. How does this transformation start? It can begin with a consultation with me to discuss your team's current practices, barriers, and to formulate a plan to help your ICU become an awake and walking ICU. I help teams master the ABCDEF bundle through education, consulting, simulation training, and bedside support.
Let's work together to move your team into the future of evidence-based ICU care. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to find out more.
Certainly, you have to be tactful and careful and cautious. But sometimes when we are so fixated on being gentle that we avoid saying the truth.
Yeah, I just couldn't keep it in anymore. And that's my personality. I just couldn't.
But that's a patient advocate as well. I think when it comes to can and should pharmacists be talking about this? Absolutely. I think about how involved and autonomous and bold you guys are about antibiotic stewardship. You would never let us give an extra gram of vancomycin because we felt like it.
Right.
And yet when our RAS scores are off, when we're giving more sedation than what's prescribed, that's again outside the RN scope. That's malpractice. That's lethal. And that should be part of pharmacy stewardship. The RAS is the trough of sedation. You would never look at a lab value knowing that it was off and be like, well, it's okay. Like the lab's probably just, you know, it's just probably that one lab tech. It'll be fine next time. You know, you'd be like, no, what, how did this happen? How do we fix this process to make sure that we have reliable lab values? Because this is toxic to the kidneys. This is dangerous. We have to know what vancomycin level these patients are at. We have to have it drawn at the certain, like you are very structured and regimented in those protocols. Why are we not the same with sedation when you know that it is an independent predictor of delirium, mortality, long-term cognitive deficits? It traumatizes and injures people, if not kills them. And yet, because culturally it's so normalized, you become the bad guy for speaking up about it.
Exactly. It was, and it's hard, you know, it's hard to see. You talk about moral injury. It's hard to, there's so many other things that happen in the hospital, but this was a big one to watch happen and have very little control over.
And yeah, let's talk about that more as from your perspective as a pharmacist, because I know my perspective as a nurse, a nurse practitioner, we're having to deal with these patients that are delirious and having to actually treat the ICU acquired weakness and things like that. I think pharmacists sometimes, I think we don't understand your relationship with patients and how much this can impact your moral injury. What did you see and how did that change your career?
So, you know, over sedation, so much delirium, I feel like I would see from patients who were, the longer people are sedated, the harder they can be to wake up. And when they do wake up, I think the more likely they are to be, you know, have delirium, whether it be hyperactive or hypoactive. But we would see prolonged vent days, you know, and then that, it's just a cascade of issues that can happen. You get an ileus because you can't move because you're too sedated. And then you have to get an NG tube put in. And then, you know, it's like one thing after the other, just cascades of events that could have possibly been prevented. And I do want to say that I do recognize there are times patients need deep sedation.
Yeah.
There are times that is appropriate. And I felt that I was pretty understanding of that too during this whole process. But when there was a case where I felt that that wasn't necessary, I really would try to speak up because of those adverse outcomes that I would see from this.
And to be told that you were talking about it too much, that wasn't a good use of time at rounds. I mean, the objective of multidisciplinary rounds is to collaborate, formulate a plan of care, make sure that everyone's on the same page, make sure that we're aligning our interventions with evidence, and make sure that we set patients up to succeed in the long run, as well as during that one shift. That all seems very relevant to sedation practices.
Yeah. And, you know, the physician who said that his rounds on 18 ICU patients would be like an hour and a half. So it's not like we didn't have time. We had time to talk about it, in my opinion. And I think, you know, we don't have time to not talk about it. It's so important. And I feel like we didn't really get attention from administration until we started talking about cost, how doing the SAT can actually improve cost, because you're going to have less patients on the vent, you know, you're going to have shorter vent times, shorter ICU stays, you're going to decrease costs. And I think that's when people really started to get interested, which is a sad state of affairs, in my opinion, because the real reason to do it is not money. It's to, you know, improve patients' lives.
To save lives. It's amazing. I mean, we do so much in the ICU to patients, and we really try to do it for patients. But some of these interventions become the exact thing that kills patients. And I think that is a really hard reality to swallow. So for you to bring that up And to put it that way, it can sound very offensive, and yet it is the reality of it. And so it's hard. So I think I have found success with getting buy-in from executive leadership teams by bringing the financial picture. I started this podcast talking all about patients, their suffering, their death, even like the clinician moral injury, things like that. But what's actually got me in the doors and bought in better staffing, equipment, training, things like that for teams is talking about the money, which is incredible. But as a clinician, what really impacts you and drives you to show up to work every day is to be able to save lives. And I think that's a really big part of our burnout and our loss of seasoned clinicians is that we're depriving our teams of having that success. And I don't think, even those that don't know that this is impacting their burnout, it does. But especially once you know, once you know what it's like for the patient, once you've read Dr. Ely's book, you've heard this podcast, and you've seen it for yourself at the bedside, how do you keep doing what we've always done? But when you can't change it, what do you do? And so how did that go for you when you hit that crossroad of, I have my clinical leaders are pressing down on me. My executive leaders are pressing down on me. My colleagues aren't listening to me. I'm continuing to see harm to the patients. How did that impact your journey after 10 years of critical care medicine, all the expertise and the wisdom and the contributions that you brought to the table? Where are you at now?
So I will say that things were slowly getting better in our unit. We had a lot of, as everyone I think did after COVID, during COVID, we had a lot of turnover. So we did have a lot of new nurses. And when those newer nurses came in, I feel like most of them were more willing to listen and to kind of learn the data and maybe learned in their training. I'm not sure. But things did get better, but it definitely remained difficult. I felt so just defeated, and it was just so tiring, and I wasn't getting that. It was so, especially during COVID, was so difficult because people were not getting off the ventilators. They were going on the ventilator. And I mean, we had a list of people that got off the ventilator, and it was like 7 people long, and it was just terrible. All of those things combined, like seeing the other ways we failed the ABCDEF bundle, we closed visiting hours. We had, as everyone did, we had no visitors. We used to have, so our former nurse manager pre-COVID, she managed to get completely open visiting hours for ICU. And she fought for that tooth and nail through her whole career. And right before she retired, she was able to get that done. And then COVID completely reversed it. And even after the restrictions ended, we still didn't let family in unrestricted. So there were still these restrictions on family. And I still saw, early mobility wasn't happening as much as it could because we didn't have enough staff and we didn't have buy-in from some of the physicians. And
our patients were still sitting
awake. Exactly. Which is the most important part, is having them awake so they can do early mobility. All of those things just kind of added up, and along with, a million other little, kind of like death by a thousand paper cuts situation of seeing all the little teeny tiny things that were happening that was just weren't the best they could have been. It just led me to want to try something else.
And I think, you're not the only one I've heard have to leave critical care medicine. And it kills me because I can understand when you dedicate your entire career, you did your residency and fellowship in this and 10 years dedicated to mastering your skill. I wish leadership understood not just the financial loss for patient care, the financial loss and losing expert clinicians, and not just expertise, but just compassion. The fact that you would work so hard to roll out a whole protocol. You weren't there just to clock in and clock out. You were there to save lives, and you were willing to do the extra work to do it. But because they weren't supporting that, they lost you. They've lost lives. They've lost so much money by failing to practice the bundle.
Yeah. It's astounding.
I mean, we had, just a little bit on early mobility, because I would be interested to hear your response. We had, so there was a 2022 New England Journal article that basically said early mobility doesn't save lives, but it increases risk of adverse events. Well, there was a lot of things. So we had a physician who would quote that all the time. And to me, first of all, you're not only worried about saving a life. Like, there's also the other outcomes, like quality of life, ability to function, ability to maintain your IQ. There's just so many other things that go along with it. And in addition, that meta-analysis, I believe it was was it a meta-analysis or just a study? But anyway, the difference between early mobility and not early mobility was so few minutes. I think it was like 10-minute difference, or I don't have the exact numbers memorized, but I would just like to hear your opinion on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking for the exact episode number, but it's called Diving Deep into the Team Study. So it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 22, I think. It was a really well-funded study. And you're right, there were it's very little difference between the control and intervention group. So there was about 12 minutes difference in duration of mobility. So the control group was probably doing a much higher level of mobility than what your team does. They were mobilizing patients within 6 days after intubation. But the median RASP during those 6 days was -2, -3. So if patients were still sedated, they did a brief, sounds like they did a brief break in sedation to mobilize, and then they were resedated. And so this was still not a full master, the ASV sedative bundle. You'll have to hear the whole episode and the discussion as far as what levels of mobility were done. It was, so the conclusion said that there was not a difference in mortality or time alive in the hospital and out of the hospital for these patients. But again, there was not much contrast. So if you'd done maybe your unit, compare them to even the control group, there would probably be a difference in mortality. But you're right, mortality is not shouldn't be our only metric that we're measuring. We should be looking at delirium rates, long-term PTSD, cognitive impairments, things like that, well after the ICU as well. But also, I think we could see, I mean, the conclusion I would draw from that study is now we know that 12 minutes of extra time mobilizing was not enough to adequately rehabilitate patients after 6 days of moderate to deep sedation. Uh-huh. That's the conclusion I get from it. But what your physician was saying is very common from what I'm hearing as far as the misinterpretation that we've had from that study. Now we know that early mobility does nothing. I've heard that. Now we know that it's too high risk. All these things are absolute misinterpretations. So you have to hear Carol Hodson say that was not the finding of the study. That was not the objective of the study. That's not what we measured. She's still a huge early mobility advocate. So that study, it's like anyone that wanted to validate their failure to practice the bundle was able to twist those last two sentences at the conclusion to validate what they're doing or not doing. But that's not an accurate interpretation of the study. So those are my thoughts on it.
And I actually, you know, that was brought up during a system-wide critical care meeting, like basically like the subcommittee, you know, it was one of those committee meetings. And I was, when it got brought up, I was texting the system director of critical care medicine being like, well, the difference in the two groups was only this. And I was trying, because I wanted him to know that, you know, there were some issues with that study and that we shouldn't be talking about it in that way.
It's really important to read the study before using it to determine practices, and also weighed against decades of research. I mean, that was in 2022, but 2007, we had a study coming out saying the adverse event rate for mobilizing patients with a PF ratio of median 89 was 0.6%. Uh-huh. But I think the difference in that study was that they were mobilized shortly after intubation.
Makes sense.
So we definitely decondition, we destabilize patients with prolonged sedation. So yeah, I think it is a lot more high risk to then rehabilitate them after letting them lose almost 40% of their muscle mass in a week.
Yes. And so, we would do that. I feel like we would do that as well, where we would wait too long, I feel like, and then it's harder to do the mobility, and then it's not early mobility. So I would say on rounds, well, at least we're doing late mobility here. And because we're not doing early mobility, if we've waited so long where it's no longer that early. I mean, it is good still that we were doing it, but
no, I love the way you put that, because that's how I see it as well. I think, and even the research, it's seen as if it's done in the ICU at some point, anytime before they leave, it's early mobility. But early is subjective, mobility is subjective, passive range of motion can be continued, like 6 days after intubation can be early mobility. But to be able to, and we don't have a very like specific time frame as far as in this window it's early, in this window it's late. But I don't think you're wrong. And I think calling it late mobility helps reinforce we may have missed an important window of opportunity to make this easier, safer. We could have rehabilitated them, prevented a lot of harm. Now, as a pharmacist, that's hard. I'm sure you had people throwing daggers your way saying, you're a pharmacist, stay in your lane. Why are you talking about mobility?
But yeah.
Yeah.
We've got to get over that.
Definitely.
It is everyone on the team's job, I feel like, to think about the bundle as a bundle. And you know, I never claim to be an expert in early mobility, but one thing I do know is that you can't do any kind of mobility if you are not awake.
Yes, so, and
we see in studies that mobility helps decrease the use of sedation.
Yes.
And so that's under your wheelhouse. Delirium is part of your wheelhouse. So that is under your umbrella. So I think it is reasonable for pharmacists to say, how about we mobilize them? Let's do an SAT to mobilize them, not just to turn the sedation on and off. We should do an SAT to get to mobility, and therefore prevent and treat delirium, and then address their agitation and their anxiety, and therefore avoid resuming sedation. So it's very relevant. That's something that pharmacists absolutely can and should be bringing up. I've heard dietitians bring up mobility for the bowels and for use and preservation and things like that. Like, everyone has some skin in the game, some reason why early mobility is relevant to getting their job done.
Definitely. Definitely.
Well, anything else you would share with the ICU community? This has been, I think, very relatable for many people.
I mean, you know, to all you people that are still in there, keep fighting the good fight and, you know, don't give up, even if you're the only person saying these things out loud. You know, the more you speak up about it, hopefully the more people will become educated about the issues and be able to improve patient outcomes.
And there's a whole community. You're not alone. You may feel alone in your facility, but this has inspired me to get the ICU Revolutionist support groups back going on again. I was doing those every month and life got busy and crazy, but we do need to get those going again, because I appreciate the support from all the revolutionists out there, but this has reminded me of how lonely of a journey it can be when you don't have people sharing your same perspective and vision.
Yeah, that's very true. Those groups would be very helpful, I think, to a lot of people.
Well, thank you for everything that you've done. I know that, you know, it didn't go exactly how you wanted to, but I'm sure that you made a huge impact and saved lives.
Thank you.
With the difference that you made there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for having me.
Thanks, Kara.
And for all the work that you do. You do such great work as well. Thank you so much.
Well, it's the community that's really driving this. Thanks.
Yes.
Schedule a consultation for your ICU, as well as find supportive resources such as the free ebook, case studies, episode citations, and transcripts, please check out the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com.